Frank, in the reports I've read of your Norton lectures, you concentrated quite a lot on the space, the kind of space that Caravaggio managed to create in his work. Could I ask you, first of all, do you see what you're doing here, or your own work, as being painting in the same kind of way? I mean, I ask that since, in a sense, you are constructing the space quite literally, rather than in an illusionistic way, simply with paint on a two-dimensional surface.
Well, in the Norton lectures, I talked about Caravaggio's pictorial space, and what I was really interested in was the space around the figures, or the space that the human figures manage to describe and activate. I think in my own work, something similar happens. You might say that the pieces of construction try to activate the space in the same way that the figures, say, in Caravaggio might, or the figures in any painting, sort of, say, after Caravaggio might. But it's, I don't think that the fact that there is... Well, the surface is not continuous. I don't have a continuous surface, and I don't have a flat surface, and I'm not indulging in traditional pictorial illusionism, although there is there's a certain amount of illusionism even in constructed objects. But the real point, I think, of the pieces is that they be constructions and be paintings at the same time. Basically, the way you look at the paintings, or the way that you have to look at the paintings, makes you look at them as pictures. I mean, they don't seem to me to require a kind of special way of looking. I mean, they're not just constructions. They're pictorial constructions. They're meant to be seen as pictures. And so I think that even though they are constructions, the space that they create is pictorial. I mean, they do manage to create pictorial as well as create pictorial space at the same time as they occupy literal space.
Is that, in a sense, the way that one looks at them straight on as you address a painting? Are you interested?
You can look at them from the side, too. I don't think it matters where you look at them, but, I mean, they do have a fairly distinct frontal point of view, and from that point of view, they look like pictures. I mean, and, for example, you're not looking at them in the same way that you might look at sculpture, although I think that most people look at sculpture in a pictorial way anyway. I mean, everyone picks a view, or whatever the view might be, the criteria that you use are really pictorial rather than sculptural. I mean, I don't think that there is a unique sculptural way of looking. There are sculptural descriptions. You might say that you're interested in the tactile quality of the material or something like that, but the way you judge a sculpture from each individual point of view, even though you might and make a route and take, you know, use a 360-degree point of view, it's made up of individuals' point of views. And each stationary point of view that you select, I think that you have a tendency to look at the sculpture in a very pictorial way. The sense of sort of balance, the kind of aesthetic and visual take that you have on a piece of sculpture is the same kind of take that you have on a painting.
Although with sculpture, I mean, there is even more the case that, however, as it were, fixed your position might be, it is occupying the same space as you. I mean, it is a three-dimensional thing.
Well, paintings are three-dimensional, too, except you don't look much at the back of the paintings. But when you take them down off the wall, you can walk around them. I mean, they have sides. I mean, paintings are not two-dimensional. They are three-dimensional.
But certainly the two-dimensionality of painting is part of the rhetoric of 20th century art, or the wordage that surrounds...
It's a pretty small part of the rhetoric, I mean, as far as I can see. I mean, you know, I don't see that, you know, it's hard to find Kandinsky or Mondrian or anyone in search of two dimensions. I mean, all painting strives to be real, and I think you can take it for granted that by that they mean three dimensions.
It seems quite central to the period in which you started to paint, or in which you came to prominence. I mean, the kind of writing that Greenberg was doing and Fried.
Well, I don't know what they wrote. I mean, I read it, but I don't remember it, as they say. But it's not, I don't think that they were an interest in surface and the qualities that painting might have that emphasizes its surface qualities is very different from being two-dimensional. I mean, a two-dimensional would really be a surface that has no depth, and all painted surfaces have depth. And they have thickness, and they have, as far as I can see, they're not even, and say Ellsworth Kelly might be the best example, but even paintings that are colored with one color have a sense of depth. I mean, I'm not arguing that flatness and the concern for flatness and surface didn't surface during the 60s. I think that that's true. But I don't think that, and I think that some of my own work had an emphasis on surface that tended towards flatness. But it was never the primary aim of my painting. And when it did get flat, it seems to me that I tended to become flatter. I tended to like it less. So, I mean, flatness wasn't my goal. I mean, the black paintings were never very flat, nor were the aluminum or copper paintings. I mean, some of the Benjamin Moore paintings tended to become tight and sort of flat. And as such, I mean, I think I was always worried about them.
What constitutes the basis for working on a group of pictures? What is there a kind of core concern?
Well, there's usually an organizational idea or a figurative idea. I mean, for example, the paintings that are here at the ICA have this certain kind of motif, the cones and pillar motif, which are kind of abstract versions of illusionism, 3D illusions. And so they're schematic versions of three-dimensional objects, such as cones and pillars. And so they run through the group of paintings, the use of those figures.
Is there any kind of sense in which you're researching through an idea and you get to the end of it and then switch on to another concern?
Yes, I mean, some things, I mean, you do enough of them or you try the things out, you see what they can do, and usually you sort of, you know, take it as far as you can. And sometimes that leads to further variations. You see how to use the idea in a different way, and sometimes the idea sort of plays itself out and you go on to something else, although that idea may come back in a different version later on. I mean, sometimes it comes back without you knowing it.
Is there any relationship between the idea of these paintings here, the pillars and the cones, and the way in which you've titled them? You've used titles from Italian folk tales.
Yes. No, well, I didn't have the titles until after I made the paintings, but they seemed to have a kind of fairy tale quality to them. I mean, they were sort of dramatic and sort of abstract and colorful, and they had a in a way, dramatic and childish, at the same time exciting in a kind of, in a way that, you know, those kind of stories are.
Could you say a bit about actually how you go about making them? Do you have people who assist you, and at what stage of the process do they help?
Mm-hmm. Well, I have a couple of studio assistants, and they generally work with me on the paintings, and there's a lot of work to be done in making the models and stuff. And I make the models, and then the models go to a factory where they're built, and in that part I don't have much say. I mean, they're following a model that I've given them, and then I go and check on what they've done, and I make adjustments if I don't like something or if they've made mistakes. But that's also a bit tricky, the process at the factory, too, because a lot of the times I work at the factory on the surfaces that are being built so that if I might etch some of the skins that are being made into a shape. If they're made in magnesium, I might draw on the magnesium, and then they'd be cut out to the shape and put into the piece. So I work on some of the things at the factory too.
What is it you like about using aluminium and magnesium?
Well, I like the metal surfaces because you can etch them, and so I can sort of bite into the metal and have a rough surface. And the other advantage is with it, the skins combined with the honeycomb make panels that are lightweight and make it possible to engineer fairly big pieces.
One idea that I've had, or that I get from reading about your work and looking at it, is this idea, this emphasis on an immediate response, an impact. I mean, I remember that phrase from the Bruce Glaser interview from all that time ago, where you're talking about...
You have a better memory than I do.
Making the paint look as good as it is in the can.
Right, right, right. That wasn't my... I mean, I got that from Hollis Frampton. That's what Hollis said, yeah. Right.
You quoted that.
Yes.
Are you actually in kind of taking that attitude, taking a stance in a sense in opposition to someone like Marcel Duchamp, who would say, let's get rid of the retinal in art, let's get back to some kind of intellect and idea, some content?
I mean, I don't know anything really about Duchamp, and I don't know that he really said that, but I mean, making a separation sort of any of the senses and the mind, I mean, it's, you know, a perilous undertaking. I mean, it just doesn't work that way. I mean, so if you, you know, if there are blind intelligences, and we know that they are, I mean, it's, you know, you have to be taught a lot in every way. But I mean, it's, you know, all kinds of, all of our perception feeds our ability to learn. And intelligence is not an abstraction. I mean, it's a process of growth. I mean, it's a growing part of a whole. And so, I mean, I don't see any point in separating it in the human beings and life experience, and I don't see any point in separation and isolation in art and the experience of art. I mean, art doesn't need to be any particular way. It may be that it can be one particular way and still be good. Great. I don't have anything against that.
I suppose in the context in which you said that, at that time, it seemed to be that it was related more to a kind of anti-Europeanism.
Yeah, I mean, at the time and still now, I mean, I'm not for sort of, you know, indulgent artistic effort, although, you know, there's nothing wrong with that. I mean, I just don't like it. I mean, and I find it really produces any art that I like or even sort of respect. I mean, the more a person worries about what kind of artist he is or worries about his work expressing his artistic identity, the less likely he is to be a successful artist, in my opinion. Now, I may be totally wrong about that. But, I mean, art is a difficult undertaking, and really, you don't have time to worry about those kind of things. You should be as direct and straightforward as you can and get on with the business of actually making the art.
What sort of opinion do you have of younger American painters? I mean, your phrase about indulgent artistic practice, would you apply that to some of the new figurative painters, people like Schnabel?
Well, yes, they're pretty aggressive, they're pretty indulgent, and they're hoping to sort of get away with it. And they can certainly make an impact using that attitude or making that kind of work, but they still have to sustain it, I mean, and they have to develop. I mean, so we'll see how it works out, if this turns out to be a way that you can make art, a kind of art that will develop, a kind of art that will grow, a kind of art that will be able to sustain itself. I mean, you know, time will tell.
Have you ever had any desire to become figurative or have any kind of figuration in your work?
I honestly haven't. I mean, I never studied art in the conventional sense. I never even really thought about it. When I was growing up, the art that I liked, abstraction was already established, and I mean, I simply liked art. I liked painting by Franz Klein, Mondrian, Kandinsky, and say, de Kooning and Pollock. That was the kind of art that I was brought up with, Barnett Newman. That's the kind of art that I admired. And that's the kind of art I wanted to paint like, and it is the kind of art that I paint like. And there's nothing in figuration that I could use or need. I mean, I don't see any, I mean, I absolutely can't see any point in it.
You mean you can't see any point in any figurative painting?
Well, not today. I mean, I can't see any point in it for myself, and I don't see much point in it for the people who practice it today. I mean, for example, most of the art, say in Europe and New York, that's fashionable, has figuration in it. But the figuration always seems to be the part that's added in the end. I mean, they sort of want to make abstract paintings, but then they sort of get nervous at the end and they draw, you know, they make a few marks to sort of locate themselves, give themselves a frame of reference. And the frame of reference is always some kind of stick figure or house or car or something, I mean, that they put into it. I mean, they get some sort of sign from the outside world and add that at the end of the painting. After they've gone through all this trouble of doing all this painterly painting, then they sort of trick it up at the end. I mean, which is, again, there's nothing wrong with it. When it works, it's sometimes quite nice and quite interesting. But for me, I find it a pointless enterprise. I mean, except when it succeeds and then it's interesting. But as a, you know, I mean, there's no need for me to even you know, consider doing anything like that. I mean, I don't need it. I can make it without it.
Is that because painting, in a sense, should refer to itself, and then if you introduce figuration, then it refers out?
I don't think painting should refer to itself necessarily, although I think for the most part that it does. But, I mean, the ultimate test of a painting is its sense of reality. I mean, you have to believe that what you see is real. And I believe that I can make painting that is real and feels as though it's real and engages you as though it were real without resorting to figuration of any kind. I don't need it. And I think my paintings are just as real as the next guy's, if not realer, than pictures that have landscapes or sailboats or naked ladies.
Could you say something about the way you're using the word real? I mean, is that simply that one has some kind of experience in front of it?
Yes, but I mean, it also, I mean, basically art is an illusion. I mean, and it deals with illusionism. And what the goal of art is to make itself, you know, essentially come to life in some kind of way. And now it doesn't actually do that, but when art is real, when it's good, you feel that that does happen to a sense. I mean, if you go see Las Meninas, you know that they're all dead, or that they're only illusions, or that they're only figures. It's not real, but it feels real, and you accept it, and you believe it. I mean, and you don't worry about it. You know it's only art, but it reaches the level of convincingness, the level of reality that you accept it, and therefore you would call it real, at least real as art gets.
I don't know whether you've read the essay that Jean Fisher has written.
No, they've kept it hidden from me.
At one point, she makes reference to something that Dan Graham said a few years ago, talking about your early work in the 60s, saying, and he allied it, rather than putting it, as it were, at the end of the Greenbergian trail through de Kooning and Pollock and Frankenthaler and Lewis and so on, he allied you much more with the kinds of concerns that the pop artists at the beginning of the 60s had. Their interest in surface, as a kind of a media surface, which was shallow, and your own impact, your own interest in surface.
Well, I don't know what the media interest in surface is, but I mean, I think my interest in surface was pretty straightforward. I mean, it was pretty much developed from what painting had always been, or at least that's the way it struck me. So, I don't know. I don't think it has much to do with pop art. I mean, the black paintings don't seem to me to be remotely related to pop art in any way, or remotely related to the media. I mean, they seem pretty much related to the kind of painting that went on in New York since 1945, maybe Newman and Rothko and that kind of painting. I mean, that's what they seem to be like to me. Or at least that's the closest reference that, you know, the context in which they seem to be the most normal context to understand them.
Yeah. At that time, you didn't feel any kind of affinity with people like Lichtenstein or...
No, I mean, anyway, you know, pop art started a few years after I was making those kind of paintings.
Yeah, I mean, I think probably now he was talking about sort of the Protractor series and that kind of...
Yeah, I think it's possible to see it in that way, but I don't think that that's what I had in mind. I was really interested in the arcs, and not so much the image, the color traveling from one end of the piece to the other, and the organization, the kind of things of organizing in circles rather than in squares and that kind of thing. I mean, my interests are pretty literal and pretty simple. I mean, I don't need a social context to sort of relate my work to. I mean, I guess I don't care what the other people are doing. I mean, in the sense that, you know, I mean, I know what they're... I only care about what people are doing in painting and what they're doing in other fields. I can't do anything about it anyway. So they're going to do it, you know. They're going to do what they're going to do. But, I mean, I don't worry about what they're doing in advertising or something like that, or, you know, whether they're selling Cabbage Patch dolls. I mean, that doesn't make my blood pressure go up.
Do you look at a lot of new art?
I try to, you know. I mean, for a while I pretty much soured on the sort of galleries and everything, and I just was tired of going all the time. But I try to see what's going on. I mean, and I exhibit fairly widely, and, you know, I don't say I'm not going to show in this show because they have, I don't know, Field Jenny or Kenny Scharf is in. I'm not going to show with people like that or something like that. I mean, I show with, you know, I show in whatever shows there are, and my work hangs with those people, and... sometimes it hangs with them or without them. I mean, I show pretty much everywhere and anywhere. And I don't, you know, and I don't say, look, I have to be isolated, or I got to be this, or I got to be that. I mean, so my work is seen with everybody else's work, just, you know, just like everybody else. And it, you know, has to find its own level.
Are there any developments that you find quite interesting?
Well, I don't know. I the only reason I find the recent developments interesting is that I thought during the 70s that it actually was possible. I was worried during the 70s, actually, that people would actually forget how to paint. I mean, everybody seemed to sort of not know how to do it. On the other hand, now, in the 80s, all you see is that everybody's proud of the fact that they went to art school. So we have a tremendous amount of advanced student painting. That's no great shakes either. So while it looked like in the 70s you were going to just have bad student painting, now we have a lot of good student painting. But, you know, I don't know how painting's going to survive. I mean, I guess it will one way or the other. But, you know, it's very hard to relate to anything outside of your own generation. I mean, my take on what happened, say, after 1970 is no better or worse than anybody else's take. On the other hand, my take on what was happening from, say, 1955 to 1965 or something like that, I think would have been very good. You know, you really have a good sense of what's going on with your own generation as it's emerging, as it's developing. Somehow you're really tuned into things. But I don't think you can stay that tuned in for very long. I mean, you sort of lived the life of your own generation and you're stuck with it.
Marinus, we're in the Anthony Reynolds Gallery in London, in front of your piece called Étude Gothique. Could we start by discussing the concepts surrounding this work, such as the manipulation of spatial metaphors expressed by the Gothic Cathedral ground plan printed onto the fabric, which is attached to a surveyor's pole? Perhaps we could start off with this work.
For me, the ground plan is the first organization of ideas. It started with that kind of thinking about the ideological aims. And for me, a ground plan is also a sort of a logos, a sign. Interests me when it is so flat, so minimal, and you have to find out what is the third dimension. There's another thing that especially the Gothical aims interest me by their transcendental purpose. You can see in every inch what they build, their aims, their purposes. The style is clear. It grows up like trees. Yeah? And in this case of this work, we've seen the textile tilt up by one point. It goes to a stick, and the stick is a common stick using by Lent meeting, Lent matter. And the last thing, the stick has the function to have the right spot. On this spot, it will happen. Yeah? And also, in another way, that sculptures has their own site, their own spot. That's the only spot they can exist. Also, the drapery of the textile is important for me to till up, to lift up a ground plan. Yeah? On the floor, the three birds in bronze, opposite what you could expect from birds that have weight laying on the ground. And that's a little bit also the theme in my work, that a work of art for me must have its own dialogue, not only the dialogue between the work as an object and the consumer, but that it speaks in itself, that it is a dialectic work. Yeah? It's very important for me. It must have yes, and it must have no, and that kind of things.
The physicality of the work, such as this, I mean, is it only important insofar as it expresses concepts and metaphors that aren't present, such as, I mean, the Gothic ground plan. Mm-hmm. I think I've read somewhere about you being interested in the way in which a Gothic cathedral, in fact, is a cultural space,
mm-hmm.
and it expresses yeah. ideas about culture.
Mm-hmm. But it has a lot to do with also that type of culture in that time, right? that you can make reflections on that time in contemporary art. Yeah, that interests me. That also interests me in the work of Lothar Baumgart, mm-hmm. yeah, to try out in an anthropological way several cultures, aims in cultures, in a contemporary time. Yeah? Mm-hmm. And, yes.
Right. Shall we, in fact, walk along the gallery sure. space now? And sure. if we walk down to the end of this space,
yeah.
and perhaps we could, you know, pursue the interest that you have and the concern that you have for space in a minute. But now we're looking at another piece which I think represents a sort of a theme in your work, which mm-hmm. is to do with absence and presence.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, it's a shadow of a chair that's been painted or sprayed onto this carpet in a spotlight. I mean, what is the sort of particular interest and use you make of this absence and presence?
This work is made in the 60s, the end of the 60s, 68. It was the beginning of the conceptual art, and it was a sort of discovering that the shadow of my chair could be a sculpture, has cultural meaning, and it was the chair I working every day in my studio and saw the shadow. I fixed it on a paper and sprayed on a little carpet, and then I placed light on it, some meters from, light on it, and then I keep away the real chair.
So you say this piece is from the late 1960s?
Yeah.
And you mentioned conceptual art, and of course when one looks at some of the pieces, you know, one certainly feels that there is a sense of belonging to that period. So yeah, I was just wondering how you would locate those kinds of concerns that were being evolved and developed in the sort of early 70s.
Mm. When we started, it was very important that you could speak about a work of art, not only speak, but that it has a sort of form of communication, that you could take it in your head, the work of art, and bring it with you to the bar, and you could speak with other people about artwork. And it was not necessary for the other one to come in the gallery and to see the work. You had the work in your head, and that was a fantastic revolution in art in the 60s. A work of Lawrence Wiener is in your head, you know what I mean? Yeah. And that was a very clear aim we had then, but later on, also by influences of other streams, yeah, you see that many of the people, that artists, work out also more pictorial things, to take sorrow that you also have an object, a picture, and you know what I mean? Mm. And you can also see in my development the last years, that the works also has a value as an object, yeah? There's not only the conceptual side, but there is a real physical side in it. Mm. Yeah?
Mm. Is that, in a sense, what has constituted the development, the fact that the physicality of the work has become much more important? Because I'm thinking of earlier works which were to do with the action of a fan or the action of a breeze, and also a piece that you made which in a sense was like a sound map and to do with space, where you set off bird scarers, small cannons, and the idea was that the person listening should create some sort of acoustic map in their head, and in fact there wasn't an object.
Yes, but for me, when I made a work with a fan, the first work with a fan was in 64. I called it Sign a Fan, It was a common fan. It was not the meaning to make a ready-made or so. For me, it was a real sculpture. Mm. Yeah? Mm. There was movement in the air, that walking along, you feel the air. That was very, very important to me, that you could discover new context for sculpture. Every work must be an evocation, yeah, about the idea in the beginning. Yeah? Mm. It must have an own dialogue, but it mustn't tell you the last word about it. Yeah? Not a definitive work. Yeah? Mm.
Can we finish, Marinus, by talking about the work you've done in sound? Because being audio arts, we'd like to complete this tape with you by including something that you've actually made. Mm-hmm. So perhaps you could, before we hear that, perhaps you could talk a little bit about it.
Yes, I've told about the sound of the fan. Another work I've made in the early 70s was To Brass the Tube. It was an order of the Dutch television to use 3 minutes time. And I brassed the tube till my portrait was disappear, and then I wait as long as it was clear. Mm. Yeah, and it was the real time, yeah, one on one. What interests me, and people has to look and spend their time to see such a simple effect. Yeah, but the sounds of breathing. Yeah. Interest me. Yeah, I can do something with brass. May I do that?
Mm, please do. Okay. Well, I'm in the Kunstmuseum in Bern with Lischke, who organized this very large and ambitious exhibition, Alles. Lischke, how did you actually originate the concept for this very large, extensive exhibition?
Well, about 10 years ago, I found this sentence, this poetical slogan, which is called Alles und noch viel mehr. You can't translate it because the real center of the idea is lost, but it would be everything and even much more. So that's a kind of ridiculous slogan, of course, and it's also ironic, and it means it is something which you can't prove. So after about 8 years, then I had the idea to collect the whole poetical and artistic media and fields together and try to give a novel sight, novel view of the actual, the 1984 production in all those different fields. And therefore, this slogan was just perfect, because it means openness and not getting ever closed, meaning everything. Everything is a mighty position, a position of power somehow. And I don't accept power games. I just want to play and to be again open for information and for new impressions. And now I had this Alles in noch viel mehr as the slogan. And then during the work, I saw that this was 26 chapters. And just by accident, I found out that this is like the alphabet has letters. So the subtitle was The Poetical ABC.
Now this exhibition really is on the same scale as a Biennale or Documenta. And in the last 5 years, of course, we've seen a lot of interest in the new painting, so-called. But this exhibition seems to redefine those boundaries. It seems to map out or remap the whole area in a very broad sense of contemporary art. Whereas I think in the last 5 or 6 years, one could say certain things have been sort of left out or ignored or put to one side. And you have, in a sense, redefined or re-examined a whole range of practices that were developing in the late 70s that we hadn't seen really over the last 5 or 6 years. So in a sense, your scan of contemporary art is very broad.
Well, that was the basic idea too. During the last years, I felt so sorry just seeing painting. I adore painting, but I think it's very complicated business to do good paintings or a job, because painting has such a long history. And I felt so sorry that you couldn't see any more nice experimental movies or photographs or videotapes or performances, whatever, which was so real, moving and interesting scene during the 70s and 60s too. So I thought, because the business had everything occupied, and you could see it in Zurich and in Basel, for example, at the art fair and at the forum in Zurich, that it is a good place, Bern, to strike back, to say, we want content, we want the open field of experimental artists and poetry, etc. And I don't accept just to be enclosed in one field, which is definitely seen at the end as something like reactionary.
I mean, in a sense, you've evolved this whole exhibition in a collaborative sense, I think. You know, you haven't actually been a gallery curator who has invited an artist to send works. You've actually actively been involved in generating and enabling artworks to take place, and the exhibition is taking place both within museum spaces, gallery spaces, but also in hotel spaces, and tonight in theatre spaces, and also the catalogue, which is in a sense a space too that you've utilised.
Well, that's the basic idea of the whole thing, to make a collaboration or a partnership between me as a philosopher and writer and other artists, poets, writers, philosophers, video artists, performing arts, etc., you know, meaning that it is without economical pressure, just in a dialogue, looking for highest quality as possible within this dialogue. And then, for example, for the exhibition, works were chosen. And not the other way around, that somebody just says, gives a phone call to a gallery and says, give me all your artists to an exhibition. I think that's a very easy way to do some things like that. Mm. And I made, let's say, a difficult job traveling around in all those 20 cities in our Western Hemisphere, which are of cultural importance, and really try to find the most interesting people in all those different fields. But not the stars, which everybody knows, but the ones who are really on work.
Well, we're in the Schweitzerhof Hotel in Bern. Marina, Ule, and Brandenbeck are also here. I thought it would be a good opportunity to find out, you know, what you've been doing, because we don't really hear much about your activities in England, certainly not in the last year or so, Marina. So, I mean, what are you currently involved with?
Our life is quite crazy. It's all the time traveling and doing different projects. And I prefer to talk first about future and then about past, and then we come to present. So the future projects, our life projects, we are preparing now and have a lot of complications to get realized, is the Great Wall of China. Did you hear about this project? Yes. No. No. When we was in Australia in 81, we got this idea to do the Chinese Wall project. Actually start from the point when we read somewhere in newspaper then when the astronauts went to the moon, they saw the only visible spot on the earth made by human hands a Chinese wall, and they could not see even the, you know, Egyptian pyramids, just nothing, only the Chinese wall. So in a way we got the idea that why we don't walk this Chinese wall. That Ulay start from one side and I start from another side and we meet in the middle. The wall is around 10,000 kilometers, so that will take a little bit more than 1 year that meeting will come. Researching about history of Chinese wall, we find out that Chinese wall is made almost 20th century, built and rebuilt and built again. And respond completely to the Milky Way of our galaxy, that actually the beginning of Chinese Wall presents the dragon head, what corresponds to dragon head on the in the stars, and the end of the wall is a dragon tail, which again, you know, corresponds to dragon tail in the sky. So the actually it's the kind of line who follow the Milky Way. And it's also very much to do with the idea that all wall is made by divining forces. Like, you know, there was, how you call it, divining? You know, looking for the energy,
Lee lines. Dousing.
Yeah, the Lee lines. And sometimes you see complete flat valley, and in our rational Western brain, the wall will be just straight, but they go completely like snake, just up and down, only looking for this energy line. So the idea is also that we're going to be exposed to these energy lines for 1 year of time and see how that look like. And there will be only two types of documentation made. One will be satellite photographs taken out of space. With helps with technology, we can make such enlargement that practically we can see the person in his shadow on the wall, but out of space. And we would like to minimize any technology while we're walking. We would like to make only paper rubbings from the wall itself, how we're walking. So Ulay will have one, you know, emotional response to the wall. He makes his paper rubbings, I make mine, and we put together, that will be, you know, the one story from two parts. And when we did try this before, we find out that the paper rubbings and the enlarged satellite photograph look exactly the same. Mm. So now it's just the question of Chinese authorities and all other things I don't want to talk about. But that's our life project.
Can we just talk a little bit about your travels to very remote places? I mean, I met you in Australia and you spent a lot of time in the central area, which is very remote. You've been to Thailand in the meantime. I mean, what particular interest do you have in very remote civilizations, contexts, cultures, and how does that experience enter into the work?
Just like to describe how we go to that such a place. Last year we went to the Rajasthan, the Thar desert on the border of Pakistan and India. And how we do this? We take the plane to Delhi. From Delhi we took the plane to the Jodhpur, the last plane can go to Rajasthan. Then we took the train to Jaisalmer, where again is the last train station goal. Then we take the bus to another place where is the last bus goal. And then is the left the camels. Then we go with the camels. And then we come to the place where is no electricity, no Coca-Cola, and absolutely nothing from our, you know, Western civilization. And then we are there. And then we stay with the real natives. So it's the, always the trip when we go farther and farther and farther that we come to the total unknown territory. And then we are confronted with the people, and they're just the most primordial form of life. And all our experience and future work, you know, developed from this kind of confrontation. And this thing with Intar Desert was just indescribable. We came there when was the special festival would happen every year, only once, when the water is in the desert, very precious thing. And it was just the festival when they offered the water to the desert goddess. And it's all, again, you know, connected with full moon night. So we've been there and, you know, watching it. And after this, we try always to come back if it's possible, and or make the work, or just leave the impression and come to the, you know, to Europe and translate the work, or to, you know, do different things with this experience. But it was the one point in Australia where we felt that it's not enough to translate to the work and, you know, take only the impressions. We made a piece in Amsterdam, part of our Night Sea Crossing sequence, where we really took the one aborigine from an Australian desert and one Tibetan Lama and invite them to come to Amsterdam and did the work with us. That was the first time that was the real confrontation of these two cultures that never met before, but also the day confrontation with our European culture. And in a way, that was the most exciting experience, because, you know, Picasso get inspired by the, you know, African mask. Was we like, and but he don't bring Africans to Paris, but really prefer that way, direct confrontation.
So when does the work concerning the Great Wall of China start? When do you actually begin that piece?
We begin in 80, we can say, and then we start to develop the, you know, the all kinds of, we start to organize the whole thing. We made foundation called AMFIS with six members of the board, and then we approached Chinese government. Now we are in a very lucky situation that the Dutch government took this project as a proposal to the China for the cultural exchange. And this moment delegation is in China, but take very long for them to say yes or no, or even they say yes, it will take very long to actually happen, because it's a very complicated administrative state, China.
So how long will it take, the actual project? A long time? You start?
When we start, we think about a year and a half. Because somebody discovered we read 3 weeks in a newspaper that the Chinese wall is 4,000 kilometers longer than it should be. It's really interesting. Little news, but very crazy for us, yeah.
So, There's so much talk about orgasm and that sort of thing. Mm-hmm. You know, where I think it's really silly. Like, I just don't feel that women have that sort of pleasure, you know, built into them.
Mm-hmm.
I think men have,
mm-hmm.
but women don't. And it's not, it's so frivolous, you know, if you're not planning on having children.
Mm-hmm.
You know. I guess I'm a real productionist, productivist.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I have a productivist attitude
mm-hmm.
towards love, maybe.
This is radio. And this is audio. And this is audio by artists on the radio.
Especially one we are not friendly with. We can't afford to have them own the bomb and push the button in the name of some religious belief or another. Abortion on demand gives women the right to make decisions governing the use of their own bodies. With a sperm bank, those of us who are infertile are able to have children and be part of the family plan. The Canada Council assistance helped to materialize certain ideas, and I don't want the government and its bureaucrats making those decisions for me. It's important that the arm's length condition.
I live in this suburb just here. You can see it on the map. The house is pinned to the top of a hill, with the others properly right along either side. It's not really a hill, but a sand dune piled up there with steep sides, proper little footpaths and streets. The people on the hill have virtually nothing to say to one another. They live inside or walk outside to get into their cars. Often they shift completely, and new people arrive in their cars and move in behind the windows and walls. When we moved in 2 years ago, we spoke briefly to the man next door, Bill. He asked if he could trim the single tree in our backyard because it dropped berries, as Cape lilacs do, and they multiplied into little lilacs all over his property.
Yes, sir, he's something to see. Yes, sir, he's something to see. Something to see. Yes, sir, he's something to see. Something to see.
This is the way I see it.
I didn't recognize the shapes.
This is the way I see it. Something didn't quite add up. this is the way we see it. Trying to put it wrong.
Life is tough without it.
That's it.
Whatever you hit, it sounds like music. They have to write on it.
I've never done it, so I guess I should try it first before I comment.
I can't sit still while watching it. It's about control.